Hi there, I'm Alistair Madden, and you're listening to Season 4, Episode 16 of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. In this episode, we looked at Xabi Alonso's presupposed managerial destiny. We looked at Sevilla's Europa League love affair. We looked at Ryan Cherki's frustrating brilliance, and we looked at Atalanta's new generation of talent. We looked at all of those topics and so much more in our usual way. Do check out the show notes for a comprehensive running order. This episode is of course produced in partnership with Freelance Football Ops. If any of our listeners are freelancing in football, you may be interested in signing up to Freelance Football Ops subscription based newsletter. They find jobs which cover writing, design, video, audio, and generally anything in football media every week. For more info, visit freelancefootballops.com or follow at FFOps on Twitter. Right, on now with the episode. Hopefully you're all staying safe and well. Thanks as always for your continued support. Enjoy. It's a beautiful evening in the south side of Glasgow. I'm not quite sure if the same can be said for Manchester. I'm pretty sure the same can be said for Madrid. Rudy Barlow's peering out of his window as we speak just to check. But anyway, Michael Jones, it looks sunny where you are. How is the weather and how more generally are you, Michael Jones?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. I'm not sure it actually is more sunny. I think that's more to do with the webcam that I've got, which is giving me this really sort of ghastly look, and certainly the look of somebody who hasn't seen enough sun recently. But that aside, better days are coming. What about yourself, Ali?
Yeah, not bad, Michael, not bad at all. I was in Paisley on the weekend to see Kilmarnock win away for the first time in the league in 407 days. So that felt quite momentous, and we marked the occasion with a good few beveraginos. A very enjoyable Saturday was had by all. But yes, Rudy Barlow, your Hearts, I'm not quite sure you can even call yourself a proper Hearts fan, to be honest, can you? Anyway, part-time jambo, shall we say. They're not enjoying the best of times, even if they did win 6-1 on the weekend. But more generally, Barlow, how are you doing? How is Madrid treating you?
Yeah, not too badly. It's clouded over a wee bit, but it is definitely warm. I can tell you that much, in case you were worried or concerned about the state of the Madrid weather. I think we're on the longest drought in many, many decades in Spain. And as a Scot, I'm crying out for a bit of rain, to be perfectly honest. But apart from that, all is well.
Good stuff. Yeah, Barlow, that reminds me of this summer I spent in Strasbourg when there was hardly any rain. And then one evening, temperature dropped from about 33, 34 degrees all the way down to about 16 or 17 degrees. Everybody else was straight into their big coats, but I was loving it. I was out in my shorts, and then the rain started, and it reminded me of, I've gone down a rabbit hole here, but of that scene in Holes with Shia LaBeouf. When the rain starts, it was almost like that. We were out at the nightclub, and I saw the rain, and I ran out to greet the rain. I must have seemed absolutely crazy. But anyway, I think we'll end the rain chat there, and we'll turn our attention to something a lot more interesting to the listener. That is German football. Great place for us to start, Barlow, isn't it?
Absolutely. There's nowhere better to start than in Germany with Xabi Alonso, who endured a difficult first month or so in charge of Bayer Leverkusen, overseeing one win, three draws and three losses in his opening seven matches. However, the Spaniard has put that poor start behind him and navigated Die Werkself away from the relegation zone towards the European places. They now find themselves in sixth place and just 7 points behind Leipzig in the final Champions League spot. Indeed, heading into their matchday 29 tie with RB Leipzig, Bayer Leverkusen were one of the most informed teams across Europe's top five leagues. Only Atletico Madrid and Manchester City had picked up more points over their previous six games. So, what factors have enabled this recent upturn in form for Bayer Leverkusen?
Yeah, Barlow, I think when we listen to the discourse, it really does feel like it is Xabi Alonso's presupposed destiny to go on to become a world-class manager. When we think about how intelligent he was as a player when we think about the way he played the game and we think about the great coaches for whom he played, we can understand the expectation, I suppose, that Alonso will go all the way to the very top, managerially speaking. Interestingly enough, former Bayern CEO Karl-Heinz Rummenigge said back in 2020 that Alonso will be a coach who may be of interest to Bayern at some point in the future. Now, he of course spent time coaching in Real Madrid's youth academy and then helped Real Sociedad's B team achieve promotion to the Segunda division. So there was plenty of hope that he could turn things around for a Leverkusen side, which, let's not forget, had made its worst ever start to a Bundesliga campaign. They'd won just one of their opening eight games under Gerardo Seoane, and which had, of course, been knocked out in the first round of the German Cup by third-tier side Elversberg. And yet, as you say, it was hardly plain sailing for Alonso in the first month or so in charge at Bayer Leverkusen, the week in which they lost 3-0 at home to Porto in the Champions League and then 5-1 away to Eintracht Frankfurt in the league was particularly sobering, shall we say. Albeit with an admittedly small sample size at that point, people were, to an extent, starting to wonder if Alonso had what it takes to succeed as an elite level manager. So, against that backdrop, Florian Wirtz's return after the winter break from the ACL injury he suffered in March last year was rather timely, to say the least. To be fair, the club had started to pick up some momentum before Wirtz was reintroduced, winning three games on the bounce. But notwithstanding that mini-run, to answer your question, Barlow, Florian Wirtz has been the single most important factor behind the club's surge up the table. And I think it's quite telling that when Wirtz didn't start the match day 28 game against Wolfsburg, the team struggled to create and looked generally underwhelming. The game finished 0-0 for what it's worth. Quite simply, we could talk at length about how Alonso has overseen this remarkable turnaround, and we do have to acknowledge that he has had a real positive impact, but for me, the difference maker has been Florian Wirtz. His ceiling, quite simply, is sky high. He's a beautiful football player. He's going to the very top. Easy to forget as well that Wirtz is still only 19. He turns 20 next week, and I was actually a bit concerned that he wouldn't be the same player after that horrible ACL injury that he suffered last March, but he's looked superb since his return. He's provided 6 assists and scored 1 goal, but his all-round play is totally transformed by Leverkusen into a much more effective outfit. Since Wirtz's return, only Dortmund have actually picked up more points in the league than Bayer Leverkusen, so keeping him fit and warding off interest from the likes of Real Madrid will no doubt be two of the main priorities for the club heading into the next season. Now, elsewhere in this Bayer Leverkusen team, as our good friends at Scouted Football noted, Bayer Leverkusen boasts potentially one of the most electric right flanks in world football on their day anyway. We tend to see Bayer Leverkusen line up in a 3-4-3 formation with 23-year-old Moussa Diaby operating as the right-sided forward and Jeremy Frimpong, 22 years of age, deployed as the right wing-back. So when the two of them are in the mood, Leverkusen are absolutely irresistible going forward. Between them, Diaby and Frimpong have 17 goals and 14 assists in the league this season. Frimpong is in the 92nd percentile for shot-creating actions, the 99th percentile for successful take-ons, and the 96th percentile for fouls drawn, which, of course, is one of our favourite metrics on the Road to Nowhere podcast. Diaby, well, he finds himself in the 90th percentile for non-penalty XG and ranks second in the Bundesliga for carries into the penalty area. Now, they're devilishly exciting players with an almost telepathic understanding. Thinking about Bayer Leverkusen as a team on the whole, there's actually a really good article on the Analyst website written by Luke Bissett, which talks at length about the style of play Alonso has looked to implement at Bayer Leverkusen, so do go and check that out. There's one particular takeaway I want to highlight from that article, which is that only Bayern have completed more shot-ending high turnovers than Bayer Leverkusen's 35. Now, what I will say is that Bayern don't press too often. They're very selective, shall we say, with their press, but they pick their moments, as you might say, and when they do press, they tend to do so with ruthless effectiveness and to really considerable success. On a similar note, using the pace of Diaby, Frimpong, and I mean, Adley Leverkusen have become the Bundesliga's most devastating side on the break. The Bundesliga website notes that they've scored a league-leading 10 goals this season from moves that began in their own half. So you see with Bayer Leverkusen this real tendency to play on the counter-attack, to pick their moment to press, but to do so with real efficiency, with real effectiveness. And we saw that again against Leipzig on Sunday. They won 2-0, and that's a result which actually has moved them closer to Leipzig. I think Barlow, when I wrote out that question, it was actually before that game. So the figures that I've given across to you are maybe slightly out of date. Bayer have moved slightly closer to Leipzig following that win on Sunday, and they've really given themselves a huge chance of securing Champions League football. They're still, of course, going to have to catch Leipzig. They're going to have to catch Freiburg. They're going to have to catch Union Berlin, perhaps. But they've put themselves in a quite remarkable position when we consider the fact that they made this terrible start, this worst start ever to a Bundesliga campaign. They were in the relegation zone. They looked lost. They were making so many mistakes. To have hauled themselves out of that position, we do have to give real credit to Xabi Alonso, even if, as I was saying earlier, the main factor, I think, behind their form has been the transformational return of Florian Wirtz. On that note, I think I will draw to a close our analysis of Bayer Leverkusen. I'll say that their remaining fixtures, I think there's, what, 5 games left in the Bundesliga campaign, they're tricky, but probably all of them are just about winnable. They're probably going to get some form of European football next season. Let's not forget that they've got that mouth-watering, narrative-laced Europa League semi-final with Roma, Jose Mourinho's Roma as well. I think their season has gone from looking down and out and, in real danger of turning into something really quite sour. It has been totally transformed by, ultimately, Xabi Alonso, and they're now looking at a really exciting end to the season. Let's follow them for sure. Let's follow Florian Wirtz over the next few years. And let's see how Xabi Alonso gets on. He's showing good signs and he's shown this ability to turn things around. Okay, we are going to take a quick break now. We'll come back in a couple of moments' time to look at Italian football. We'll be right back. After discussing Napoli's first leg against AC Milan in depth on our last episode, it's safe to say it has been a mixed week for the club from Naples, who recovered from Champions League elimination with a last-gasp winner over Juventus on Sunday to surely seal the Scudetto, a first Scudetto in 33 years. Now, mixed fortunes are certainly a feeling to which the old lady can also relate. Despite their defeat on Sunday night against Napoli, I Bianconeri had, of course, been given a reprieve earlier in the week when their 15-point deduction was overturned. So, Michael, what are the wider implications of this saga, both on and off the field of play for Juventus?
Yeah, I mean, on the face of it, Juventus are up into third despite that defeat at the weekend, and they're likely to get into the Champions League, or they're likely to qualify for the Champions League. And you can say, you know, well, it's good ultimately that the Serie A is being decided, the league table is being decided by sporting actions as opposed to legal ones. But I think if you take that statement without understanding any of the context surrounding it, it is quite problematic. And that is because of the can of worms, the Plus Valenze case, one we discussed back in January, which is Italian for a capital gains case, has exposed. And, okay, they've got their points back. We're not yet at the end of it. There's the final criminal hearing into some of the alleged capital gains activity next month, and UEFA still are able to intervene, which could be quite likely. And they could apply transfer embargoes and banning them from further competitions. So to say Juventus are sort of safely into next season's Champions League or European football at a minimum is probably a bit early to confirm so far. And, you know, given Juventus's relationship following the Super League just a couple of years ago, you'd certainly say UEFA won't be sort of offering them a sympathetic take or view when dealing with them. But Yeah, this kind of worms doesn't just go from the kind of legal proceedings and the case that's been ongoing for a couple of years now. I mean, you know, this is one, just a quick reminder, it started in January when the point deduction happened. Previously, Italy's watchdog had said that they weren't going to pursue the case, but then it was reopened by public prosecutors in Turin. And due to that, we saw the arrest of Andrea Agnelli, the Juventus chairman. Paratici was banned from football as well, and subsequent actions through raids and wiretaps gave prosecutors enough evidence, they believe, to find Juventus guilty. But sort of as this case has unravelled and developed, you know, Juventus are 700 million euros roughly in debt. They've been sort of remortgaging parts of their club and rearranging finances through recapitalisation, and, you know, there's been multi-hundred million euro cases of that which have been taking place. And I think it is really laid bare the problems with Juventus, particularly as a publicly listed club, which is why they've found themselves at the centre partially of this ordeal as well, if you can call it that. But also it's exposed some of the real problems facing not just them, but a lot of teams all around Italy. And, you know, in terms of the TV money, this is a league where teams are getting a tenth of what Premier League clubs are getting, significantly less than what La Liga clubs are getting. And it really just lays bare that, you know, the poor financial situation Juventus are in. And even if they are to secure Champions League football for next season, which I do believe they will get in one of those qualification places, or if not, they've got a very good chance at winning the Europa League, that, you know, they will be, they will still not be in, you know, they will not be the superpower they once were. And, you know, I think you look at that game on Sunday versus Napoli, and Napoli had gone on a bit of a barren run in front of goal. Okay, Osimhen scored a late goal versus AC Milan in that game, but ultimately the game was done by that point as a last minute of stoppage time. But Napoli's barren run, that was ended by Giacomo Raspadori, a great volley. And even though it wasn't technically a title winning moment for Napoli, it, you know, they still have to win at least one more game. They could win it in the next game week. It certainly felt like that title winning moment for Napoli, and it was a lovely turnaround for them after what was a really difficult week. And, you know, there was a question over whether Wojciech Szczesny could have done better, but I'm not going to sort of provoke the goalkeepers union into a discussion that we had with Alex Murray last week. But yeah, like I said, it felt like a title winning moment, and there was despair for Juventus just earlier on as well. Angel Di Maria had scored a brilliant goal, which was disallowed for an earlier foul from Arka Milik on Stanislav Lobotka. But it was certainly a sliding doors moment, and, you know, coupled in with the fact of sort of Juventus's finances, you know, this has been a season where looking at the struggles that Italian teams have had in terms of how competitive they can be in the transfer market. You know, they spent a fraction of what Premier League teams have spent. They've still had these, you know, miraculously successful European campaigns. Napoli have sort of outlined themselves as one of Europe's best teams this season, even though they're out. We've got an all Milan semi-final. Roma and Juventus find themselves going into the semi-finals of the Europa League, and Fiorentina are in a great position, likewise, in the Conference League as well. And I think we've also discussed this new wave of Italian football free Gasperini, but all this has been happening around Juventus, and I wouldn't say an unhappy marriage, but, well, maybe I would actually. You know, they've been tied into this unhappy marriage with Massimiliano Allegri, who, when he returned, was expected to do great things. But as details of this case have emerged, it appears he's been trying to manage Bianconeri with his one hand tied behind his back, or even two at times. And, you know, we talk about the wiretapes and, you know, what they've heard and stuff. You know, he's talked about how his transfers were dictated by the capital gains, and in, you know, politer terms, he said it's a messed up market that they have been operated in. And it's just a real indicator of, you know, how far this team has gone. I think Cristiano Ronaldo was also seen sort of that signing as a sliding doors moment that led to the departure of Beppe Marotta, who is now Inter Milan, but was key to sort of getting Juventus back together after their last massive scandal, the Calciopoli scandal. And I think since then, that sort of stagnant recruitment, the famous case with Milan Pjanic and Artur Melo. And, you know, the very best case scenario for Juventus now is that they do qualify for the Champions League. They don't face any further sanctions from UEFA. They don't receive any more punishments. And they are able to sort of slowly put it behind them and just focus more on footballing matters. But even then, when you look at the footballing matters, we've now got a legacy of players where it's becoming more and more obvious and, you know, transparent through hearings and stuff, of players who weren't really signed for the club for footballing reasons necessarily. And for a team that is Italy's most supported club, I think it's just going to have such a long-lasting damaging legacy on the club. And, you know, it's a real shame for their fans. But, you know, given the size of the club, I think, you know, they're not going to be disappearing just like people thought. Just like it's the case, you know, Barcelona won't be disappearing anytime soon either. And I think eventually we'll be seeing them, you know, challenge. And they're always going to have the lure of players wanting to play for them because of what they are and what they've achieved in the past. But, you know, I think Allegri's going to be there next season. Questions over what competitions they will be participating in next season. But it's a club that I think has got a long, long way to go before they ever sort of dream of winning the hearts back of many fans, you know, outside of the sort of Juventus supporters groups.
Yes, as you mentioned, Barcelona won't be disappearing despite the best efforts of, as you said, Maria Bartomeu. But back in Italy, as you mentioned there, the removal of Juventus point deduction has had ramifications for teams across Italy. One of those who have suffered from the spillover are Atalanta, who looked set to miss out on another season of Champions League or even the Europa League, with La Dea dropping into seventh. The prospect of another season without European football would hurt for those in Bergamo, and yet their triumph over Roma on Monday night has propelled them back into the race for the top four. Can this result be the springboard for Giampiero Gasperini's European push?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was an absolutely huge victory for Atalanta on Monday over Roma. I mean, the table position for them doesn't lie. And, you know, seventh could, in theory, get them Conference League qualification, which wouldn't be a bad thing if you look at the success Fiorentina have had in it this season. But they're a team who have been in the Champions League the last few seasons, and they'll be striving back to get there. And it's put them within reach again. It was really exciting game, one which Atalanta really did play on the counter-attack. And I think Roma's emphatic victory over Feyenoord, the 4-1 victory, which went to extra time last week, which saw, you know, Paulo Dybala star, and we saw all sorts of Jose Mourinho's antics on full display. I think many people are expecting a very confident Roma team, and they did certainly take the game to Atalanta, but they were hampered by a disastrous error by former Wolves goalkeeper Rui Patricio. There's been a lot of discourse on the Wolves goalkeeping scenario at the moment, and seeing that error was a nice reminder of, you know, how good he was for us, but, you know, more of a reminder of the kind of bizarre decisions he could make, which led to Tegan Koopmeiners scoring the third goal. Pasalic just scored a great first goal, and Rafa Toloi had volleyed in the second one. And, you know, in after all this really sort of funny moment, I found Martin Doreen is probably one of the best footballers to follow on Twitter. After sort of Mourinho had fallen out with Arne Slot, the final manager, he tweeted a picture of him holding up his middle finger, referring to the fact that he's from Rotterdam himself. But yeah, getting back to the more serious stuff, you know, there was many elements of this performance that were kind of similar to Atalanta as a Champions League team. The way they got bodies forwards, the attack sort of being spearheaded by Duvan Zapata, who I'll get onto in a moment. And he's a really interesting character for Atalanta coming into the summer, because European qualification is going to be absolutely huge for La Dea at the end of this season if they're able to make it. You know, Giampiero Gasperini, I think there are questions over whether he would remain in the job going into this season. He's definitely had an improvement on last season. Those numbers speak for themselves in terms of their goals per game, and a lot of the other metrics would also support that. But they've also sort of seen the breakthrough of what we do believe could be the next generation of massive players for Atalanta. And, you know, Rasmus Højlund's the obvious one. We discussed him right at the start of the season. He's now being linked to Manchester United. They have said with him, it may be impossible to keep him if a big money offer comes in. But Adam Ola Luckman, really seems to have found a home in Bergamo. Giorgio Scalvini, player looks like he'll be a pillar, along with Caleb Accoli, two really exciting young Italian centre-backs slash midfielder for Scalvini. And Tyrone Coupe-Miners, who's become the heartbeat of this Atalanta team, much in the way that the likes of Papu Gomez were as years before. But we still have the experience of Zapata and Rafa Toloi, who both starred in this victory over Roma. And, you know, inconsistency has marred this season, and Atalanta showed the levels that they could get to there, but they tried to sort of approach this one in a very different way. They sort of began with a really solid defensive base, and going forwards, they translated that into some really exciting, more typical Atalanta performances, maybe most notably an 8-2 victory over Salernitana back in January. But ultimately, counter-attacking has been key to a team that has been, you know, renowned for their possession-based play for a long time. You know, they had 37% possession in their win against Roma. They really just looked to hit them on the counter-attack. But in terms of this team that's maybe lost at odds with some of the older players, some of the more experienced players like Darun and Pasalic, players who maybe don't know where their football lies for next season as well, that I think it's a team without hugely obvious leaders in that dressing room. And, you know, barring their first defeat to Lazio, that's shown on the pitch, they've not responded to a loss all season since then by winning the next game. They've either drawn or lost. So it's normally ended on them. And those kind of dropping points in consecutive weeks has been hugely detrimental to their hopes of European football. And, you know, one of their main hopes in terms of getting that consistency back could be the return of Zapata. You know, he's only managed 12 minutes per 90 this season. He's only scored one goal. He's hit double figures, I think, for four seasons in a row. This looks set to be the first, unless he scores nine in his last seven games. But he ran the channels brilliantly for Atalanta during the game. He's, you know, he a brilliant cross to set up Pasalic for the first goal. He's, you know, his percentiles are still really good, obviously taken into account. But over the last year, in terms of progressive passes, carries, where he ranks among strikers, both above sort of the 85th percentage mark compared to other strikers in the major European leagues. And it's just a case of, you know, whether Atalanta can kind of get together for one last big push until the end of the season, and whether they can find ways of sort of being able to control games with sort of large possessional play, which they still have had to do against teams that will be even more reluctant than them to have the ball at times, such as Lecce or other teams who've done the double over them this season. But they have got a winnable run of games. The last seven games this season, only Juventus and Inter are in the top half of the table. And if they are to win 6 out of 7, they'd need 70 points, which I think is benchmark Champions League. So it would take a tremendous effort for them to get there. But 4 or 5 wins will get them closer to 65 points, which I believe will be the marker for Conference League football. So, yeah, certainly all is not lost for Atalanta. And, you know, given their tremendous performances in Europe in recent seasons, it'd be really fantastic to see them compete on some of the biggest continental stages next season.
Yeah, for sure, Michael. I think those European competitions are a better place when Atalanta are competing in any one of the three European competitions. So, yeah, let's hope that they can qualify. And yeah, we'll look forward to seeing this new generation to which you refer blossom under Giampiero Gasperini's guidance. Okay, on that note, I think what we'll do is we will turn our attention to Spanish football. We'll take a quick break just now to fill up our water bottles, and yeah, we'll be right back. We spoke about them just two episodes ago, but there's nowhere else to start in Spain. Sevilla, enduring their worst season in 23 years with their third manager of the campaign and only just coming out of a relegation battle, Sevilla have knocked Erik ten Hag's resurgent Manchester United out of the Europa League. 3-0, they crushed the Red Devils. Is there any way, Barlow, of explaining this other than through Sevilla's special relationship with this competition?
Yes and no. I mean, on the one hand, it is very much a special relationship with the Europa League, and the fact that they do seem to adore that competition, the fact that they seem to be more linked to that competition than anyone else, in the same way that Real Madrid are with the Champions League. And it's been very much a narrative in Spain over the last couple of weeks that this is Sevilla's competition, that they have something special in it. And it's really hard to deny that. But Mendilibar, we spoke in kind of that recent episode about how he's come in, and the one thing that he's focused on, the one thing that he's tried to do more than anything else, is not to be Jorge Sampaoli, who was really frustrating the players with his methods, with the fact that all of his plans had to be followed to a T, that there was no room for flexibility. It was his idea, Jorge Sampaoli's way, or a la Galatera, it was either his way or the highway. It really was very much, there was no kind of room for the players to have an input. And where you see sort of a different from Mendilibar, who's idiosyncratic himself. He has a very defined style. He likes to press high. He likes to play 4-4-2 all the time. He likes kind of slightly, usually as a target man, usually has pace out wide. And he's done all that with Sevilla, but he's been very careful to tailor his message, as we were saying, to say that I'm going to play people in their position. I'm not going to ask too many complicated things of them. I want this side to be comfortable, essentially. And the players are enjoying that. They've played 6 games since he came in, 13 goals in those games, at least 2 goals in every single game. Manchester United had the honour of being the single side to concede a few more, and 5 conceded, which isn't too bad. I mean, I think that there will be a slight coming down to earth, it has to be said, because I think in every single game they've scored from a set piece. I think that at times they've rode their luck, but that's been where this Mendilibar side has kind of taken advantage of the opportunities they've had in a very kind of unique way. And I think it's comparative to Real Madrid in the sense that, particularly against Manchester United and particularly kind of in the Europa League, you see that Sevilla have an appreciation of the pressure points of a match. And it's kind of like they feel exactly where on the neck to touch someone to kind of knock them out. And they do that with teams. And it was very hard for me not to draw a comparison to David De Gea with some of his slightly bizarre choices and bits of play in that second leg, especially to Gianluigi Donnarumma. Gigi Donnarumma, who was fouled against Real Madrid in that tie when they were knocked out by Real Madrid last season. And he should have cleared the ball. I mean, he waited far too long for the ball, for Benzema to get close to him in pressure. And it's those kind of specific bizarre errors that look like luck, and in a certain sense that they are, but it's the pressure that they apply, the belief they have, that extra 2 yards that they go when they know that they have a team under pressure, when they know that the opposition are there to be kind of malleable. And so yeah, I think that's what Sevilla have done very well. You've seen Jesus Navas has been resurgent at the age of kind of 36, 37 or so. Marcus Acuna, we've spoken about, has been very good all season, but he's going even more kind of from strength to strength. And then Lucas Ocampos as well has been brilliant since he came back from Ajax, despite the fact that he was dreadful at Ajax. He barely got a look in 112 minutes, I think, he played for them. And in particular, you look at Ivan Rakitic, who consistently all season has looked past it. He's looked off the pace. He's looked slow. He's looked kind of like a player who's run his race. And although he's still experienced, although he still has that knowledge of where to be, he doesn't quite have the legs to make a difference. He doesn't maybe necessarily have the ability to get himself into those kind of positions where he has the technical quality to make a difference. And against Manchester United, he dictated the play. He was absolutely fantastic. He was sensational. You saw sort of multiple occasions where it was Rakitic on the edge of the box, playing it left, playing it right, looking over the top kind of thing. And that just hasn't happened. And so you've got to give Mendilibar credit for what he's done with Sevilla, for the confidence that he's inspired and for the reaction that he's getting out of his players. And I think it's a wider and more interesting debate to be had in the near future, I think, that these managers who are consistently dealing with players in kind of bottom half of the table sides, as Mendilibar has been for most of his career, and they do a good job at those sides, but they never quite get a chance. And on the one hand, you kind of look at it and you say, well, maybe they don't have the ability to manage those egos. Maybe they don't have the ability translate those skills to a bigger side, translate it to a more kind of intense media furore or something that's it's kind of bigger. You have to be more ambitious with your game plans too. But on the flip side, if you never get the chance to work with those better players, and Mendilibar did have a very brief spell at Athletic Club in the kind of mid-2000s, but if you never get the chance to work with those better players, and if you get pigeonholed into that kind of one box of this is what I do, and these are the type of teams that I take over, and Mendilibar, who's come from Segunda B, he's come from kind of the regional divisions, he's right through kind of the pyramid in the chain of Spanish football, has never really had the chance to work with a Sevilla side that, although we would say it's kind of lacking in quality compared to Sevilla of recent seasons, is far greater in quality compared to sides that he's recently been in charge of. So yeah, credit to Mendilibar, and it's fascinating to see somebody that typically wouldn't have had this chance, but because of the desperate situation Sevilla were in, did get this chance, and now he's one European tie, he's knocked out Manchester United, and he has the chance to go after Europa League with Sevilla against Juventus.
Yeah, absolutely beautiful stuff. And speaking of teams with special relationships, Real Madrid face off against Manchester City in the Champions League semi-finals. Before that, they face Osasuna in 8 days. That will define their season. Firstly, take us through where Osasuna might be able to have some joy against Los Blancos in the Copa del Rey final, and then give us one or two areas where you feel they themselves might be able to cause Man City issues.
Yeah, Osasuna should be an interesting one, because if you look at the previous ties, I think the thing that I find interesting is at El Sadar with the Osasuna fans, which has typically been a very difficult place to go for teams over the 21st century, Real Madrid have kind of dealt with it pretty well. They've managed to kind of deal with the pressure, they've played a very vertical game and managed to cut through this Osasuna side. But when you get to the Bernabeu, when the pressure's been on Real Madrid and it's been upon Los Blancos to kind of make the run in, it's been upon them to kind of create and that kind of thing, it's been Osasuna who maybe not necessarily have had a lot of joy, but they've caused Real Madrid problems. They got a draw earlier in the season, a Kike Garcia header, and Real Madrid kind of really struggled to break them down. And so I think it'll be interesting, because the pressure will definitely be on Real Madrid as a cup final. Of course, you can say that Real Madrid have the experience. They don't tend to feel pressure in finals either. But it certainly will be on them to make the running and make the play. Whereas you look at a lot of their success in the Champions League tends to be against teams that they are allowed to kind of sit back a little bit deeper. Or if you look at the winning goal in the Champions League final against Liverpool, Modric starts it in the right back position. You look at the way they beat Manchester City and the other teams, Chelsea, the likes of PSG, it was very much the other teams were attacking as well, or certainly attempting to go forward. Chimi Avila, I think, is an interesting one. Ferland Mendy's probably not going to be back for this game. Wherever you start Nacho Fernandez, who's a more out-and-out defender, but Eduardo Camavinga certainly won the battle to be the starting left-back just now. He's been fantastic, but if there's one thing that he lacks, or if there's one thing that works against him, it's his lack of kind of a natural position as a fullback. We touched on that as well last week. And if you have a natural striker playing on the right-hand side, as Chimi Avila does, then perhaps you look at that as a way that maybe his movement, maybe his appreciation of where to be when the ball comes across the box to that back post, that's somewhere that perhaps Osasuna can exploit. Ez Abde, who has been very much in the press in Spain and very much appreciated by people at Barcelona as well, and particularly at Osasuna, he's been crucial on their run to the Copa del Rey final. I look at him, and Dani Carvajal always seems to come up big in those big games in the Champions League, but in the Copa del Rey final, perhaps maybe he's at his kind of typical level, shall we say, in La Liga, which hasn't been quite so good. And Ez Abde gets a run at him, he gets a chance to go after him, and in space as well, that will be remembered, because Real Madrid, as I say, will be have most of the ball. So yeah, Ez Abde is perhaps another area, and Moy Gomez is the key linchpin in midfield. I was at Rayo Vallecano a couple of weeks ago, and Moy Gomez came on, I think it was at halftime, but just changed the game entirely. He used to play at Villarreal. He was kind of always good, but not great midfielder, never quite had the keys to the team in the same way that he does this Osasuna side. And yeah, when he got the ball, whenever he got the ball, he brought kind of a sense of calm, and ease, kind of spraying one touch, kind of switches across the park. He scored a brilliant goal where he cuts inside, just glides past the defender and bullets it into the top corner. And yeah, I think he's one of those key players that when you're under pressure, when you need that little bit of a breather, Osasuna will look to him to get the ball and to play out pressure a little bit. And he has to be on his game in order to allow them to do so. Now, coming on to Real Madrid, as we know, there'll be, I think I still make City kind of favourites, even though it's been mooted, it's been put to the press, it's been put to Ancelotti as to why are the City side favourites in the Champions League, given Real Madrid's record, given they beat them last season, given they're the current European champions. I still make City slight favourites, and I still expect City to dominate the ball, as I think most people would. I look at the first leg against Bayern, and some of those opportunities, a lot of them seem to come through Leroy Sané kind of running at the defence in behind, looking at that back three. And Vinicius Jr. is Leroy Sané on steroids. He's absolutely on fire this season. He's almost unplayable. He's very difficult to stop. So I would always want kind of someone backing up whoever's defending Vinicius. And do you have that in a back three in a system that presses high? I don't quite know. So Vinicius Jr. is a very obvious person to go for as a big threat, but certainly one that I think Real Madrid will look to get in behind. And then there's that question that we were talking about, Rodrigo or Valverde. Which one does Ancelotti go with? Does he go for a more defensive formation with perhaps Nacho at left back? Or does he go for Eduardo Camavinga at left back and then he moves Valverde into midfield? Whatever Valverde is, I think he's going to be crucial because he's the one with the legs in that midfield to get beyond the front line. He's the one that can tirar desmarques, as they say in Spanish, which is kind of just lose your marker to make a run that kind of brings you into space that will stretch the City team, that will give them a chance to get in behind them, but also to play out through them. Because if Kroos and Modric have a little bit extra space to work with, then that's where I think they'll try and find the joy against City. And you saw that, again, to refer to it, just because it's a very iconic goal. It's a very, I think it's summed up a lot with what this Real Madrid side are about. That goal against Liverpool, you saw Modric kind of taking the ball and playing it at right back, but it's Valverde who gets down that right-hand side, who people struggle to stay with him, struggle to stay with the lungs that he has. And so I think wherever he plays will be pretty significant. And if that's in midfield, going kind of doing a lot of the defensive dirty work, or if that's on the right hand side instead of Rodrigo. But yeah, fascinating ties to come, and fascinating tie this evening as Real Madrid have just gone 2-0 down to Girona.
Beautiful stuff, as always, Barlow. Yeah, that the Copa del Rey final seems quite mouthwatering when you put it like that, Barlow, and also that Champions League semi-final between Real Madrid and Manchester City promises to be a barn-storming tie. Okay, well, with both of those games to look forward to, I think we will draw our analysis of Spanish football to a close there. We'll be back shortly for part four of the podcast to talk about French football. We're going to put Lyon under the Road to Nowhere microscope. We'll be right back.
In France, Laurent Blanc's Lyon have started to turn bread into wine. The 7-time champions of France quite remarkably lead the Ligue 1 form table heading into match day 33, having picked up 25 points from a possible 36 since their sobering home loss against Strasbourg in mid-January. Placing the 7-time champions of France under the Road to Nowhere microscope, what have been the key takeaways from their recent purple patch and, looking ahead, have we seen anything to suggest that the club could take this form into next season and challenge PSG for the league title, fingers crossed?
Yeah, Barlow, as you say, fingers crossed, but as I'll discuss later in this section, I don't think we should hold out too much hope for Lyon genuinely challenging PSG for the league title. But stranger things have happened, and specifically in league, and stranger things have happened. So I watched Lyon lose that game you mentioned against Strasbourg back in January, and they were absolutely awful. They were a shambles defensively. Strasbourg overpowered them in midfield, and Lyon looked like they could have played all night and not scored from open play. Anyway, now that result left them in ninth place, exactly halfway through the season, through the league season, closer points-wise to the relegation zone than the European spots. That defeat did, however, seem to serve as a catalyst of sorts for Lyon. They've only lost once in the league since then, or they had rather only lost once in the league since then, going into their game with Marseille on Sunday night, which they went on to lose in quite comical fashion. But they are within touching distance of the European spots. The defeat against Marseille was a setback, but perhaps there is still some hope that they can claw a European place out of, well, what seemed like nothing. Over the course of that run, before the loss against Marseille, they'd mostly gone with a 4-2-3-1 or a 4-3-3 formation, and that was spearheaded by Alexandre Lacazette. Lacazette, of course, captains the team, and his goals have been crucial to this recent run. Since the Strasbourg loss, Lacazette has netted 9 league goals in 10 appearances, and Lyon's only real wobble over the last 3 months or so actually coincided with Lacazette's absence from the squad in late February / early March. Now, in total, he's netted 20 league goals this season, only killing Mbappe, and Jonathan David can better that in Ligue 1. And I think what we do have to say, Barlow, is that Lacazette brings a certain confidence to this Lyon side, and it's almost as if he's this reassuring presence who's been there, who's done that, and who's got the proverbial T-shirt. But quite aside from his goals, quite aside from his movement, his build-up play, Lacazette's experience and level-headedness, I suppose, is of huge psychological importance to Lyon. Now, a player at the other end of his career, and a player who perhaps lacks, shall we say, a certain level-headedness at times, is Ryan Cherki. And it feels like Ryan Cherki has been around forever, but he is still somehow only 19 years of age. He, of course, made his league and debut all the way back in October time, which feels like BC almost when we think about what's happened since, what with the COVID pandemic and everything else. But this season, it really does feel like Ryan Cherki is starting to kick on and deliver. Now, Laurent Blanc has typically deployed Cherki as a 10 behind Alex Lacazette and Bradley Barcola, giving him the keys to the ignition and the freedom to really express himself. He's also been played out wide on the left, but it does feel like he thrives most when he's playing in that number 10 role behind two strikers. Cherki has provided 3 goals and 5 assists in the league this season, and he finds himself in the 99th percentile across the top 5 leagues for shot creating actions, the 99th percentile for successful take-ons, the 97th percentile for progressive carries. And going into the game with Marseille, he sat 3rd in Europe's top 5 leagues for expected assists per 90, only Kevin De Bruyne and our good friend Leo Messi sat above him for that particular metric. Now, with Blanc and Cherki, it does feel like there's a sort of father and son dynamic going on. Blanc said previously that Cherki is a boy who has a lot of talent. Everyone is practically unanimous on that. He has a lot of talent, but it is necessary to use it well and use it for the good of the team. That wasn't always the case with Ryan, and that led to some heated discussions with him. And there's a sort of tough love approach here as well. After the Toulouse game, Blanc said, matter of fact, am I happy with Ryan's match? No. But that approach is paying off. And with promising players, sometimes all it takes is the right coach, like Blanc in this instance, to come along to enable them to realise their potential. And it feels like Laurent Blanc's style of coach, Laurent Blanc's man management, shall we say, were exactly what Ryan Cherki needed. Against Marseille, I do have to say I was disappointed with Cherki's performance. He was slightly off the pace. His touch wasn't quite there. Technically, he wasn't as good as we know he is. But I like to think that was a mere bump in the road to become a really top player for Ryan Cherki. But we do, I suppose, just need to wait and see. Quite simply, there are few more exciting players with the ball at their feet right now than Ryan Cherki. He's a mercurial talent for sure. And if Lyon are playing and he's in the starting 11, you just have to watch him, but take it with a pinch of salt and consider what I've just said. There are the occasional, or there rather is the occasional performance where he is, yeah, slightly below the levels that we know he can deliver. I would Just also like to briefly mention Bradley Barcola too. He's 20 years old and, like Cherki, is a product of the prestigious youth academy, and he's also, like Cherki, benefited massively from Ron Blanc's appointment earlier this season. He's netted 5 goals and provided 3 assists in 20 Ligue 1 appearances, 9 of which have been starts, including the match winner against PSG in the capital at the start of April. A really memorable goal for Barcola and for Lyon on the whole. Interestingly enough, Lyon have not lost any game in which Barcola has scored, so there's sort of good luck omen going on there as well. So I've mentioned Lacazette, I've mentioned Cherki, and I've mentioned Barcola, and that attacking trio is blossoming into something really positive for Lyon. I think it's not perfect, but it's definitely heading in the right direction. So you've got Lacazette's experience, you've got Lacazette's mercurial promise, and you've got Barcola's off-ball movement, to name but a few of their many traits. And that all comes together really quite nicely to make Lyon a real threat more often than not in the final third. The fact as well that all three players graduated from Lyon's youth academy adds a little extra spice to the narrative. Now, I must admit, coming now to Laurent Blanc, I must admit that I was surprised to see Lyon appoint Blanc in October, and I'm even more surprised that he's managed to oversee such an impressive run of results recently. He hadn't coached in Europe, let's not forget, since leaving PSG back in 2016. And so much changed in French football's top flight since then, in terms of players were involved, the managers, the tactics, everything, perhaps even the level itself has risen quite a lot in Ligue 1, arguably over the last few years. But that said, I do think Ligue 1 is a better place with Blanc around. He's a very eccentric figure. He's quite forthright in his press conferences, and his players at Lyon really seem to be buying into what it is he is trying to do at the Groupama Stadium. So just before, actually, I engage in some crystal ball gazing, shall we say, and look ahead to Lyon's prospects next season, I'm quite keen to hear Michael's thoughts on Laurent Blanc as a coach more generally. Now, Michael, you've mentioned quite a few times that you're a real admirer of Laurent Blanc's. What is it about him that you enjoy so much?
Yeah, I mean, I can't back much of what I'm about to say in the next minute or two. But what I would say is, you know, like you said, he comes across a very affable guy. He is, yeah, a lot of redeeming qualities sort of as a person, it would seem, from the outset. And I think, you know, there's that strange affinity with both, you know, him as a player, that famous Barthez moment. But he's also a guy who's won 4 Ligue 1 titles with Bordeaux, Paris Saint-Germain. You know, I feel that France team he got dealt with in the early part of last decade was one of the worst French teams in about 30 years, or probably 40 or 50. I think that's probably an insult to other teams of that generation before they've, you know, proceeded to have the best sort of development of young players in the world over the last 10 years. And then, yeah, I think I've also just got this very strange affinity with managers that have taken a long time out of football and then just are like, you know what, I'll have another go at it. And, you know, whether that's Laurent Blanc, Louis Fernandez, of course, former PSG legend, player and manager. I think he's been out since 2016. Juan de Ramos, where's he gone? Or Alan Kirbishley. In all seriousness, I think, you know, Blanc's football, I always enjoyed watching when I was younger with PSG. I think it was probably the most likeable PSG team that I can remember. And that was sort of under his tutelage. And yeah, I'm hoping for more of the same. And of course, there's the new owner or new investor at Lyon as well, who, you know, had been trying to take João Gomes off Wolves. Happy that didn't succeed. But yeah, it seems quite exciting times from the outside.
Yeah, absolutely, Michael. I think what with your affinity for managers about the game for quite some time, I might just suggest that Wolves appoint Raymond Domenech there. How happy would you be about that, Michael?
Absolutely not from my own perspective.
Yeah. And on the topic as well, it's quite funny you mentioned Alan Kirbishley. I've got a good friend, Matt Clark. I don't think he listens to the podcast. I'd be highly surprised if he listened to the podcast, but stranger things have happened. And yeah, he's always putting Alan Kirbishley's name forward whenever there's a vacancy at any job going in any league in European football. So perhaps Kirbishley will surprise us and pop up at a club in the not too distant future. But I must say, I would be quite flabbergasted were that to happen. Okay, yeah. So turning our attention back to the more serious matter of Lyon and looking ahead, even if Lyon do manage to keep the front three together, that front three of Cherki, Lacazette and Barkla. I'm still not fully convinced that this Lyon team is good enough or consistent enough to challenge PSG over the course of a full season. Yes, in isolation, in one-off games, in purple patches, they can be brilliant, but they just have too many games in them where they'll fluff their lines. Now, the case in point was that game on Sunday night against Marseille, not the most enjoyable of 90 minutes of football, and it ended with a really comical own goal from Malo Gusto. I don't think Alex Collins, good friend of the pod and a big Lyon fan, could quite believe what had happened there. If you've not seen that own goal, do go and watch it. It's quite something, this own goal. Yeah, baffling. Anyway, I think that was the case in point of Lyon fluffing their lines, and it's a bit like what we see with Dortmund in the Bundesliga. The neutral almost wants to see them do well, as they feel like the most natural challenge to PSG's relative hegemony. But all too often, they let us down. In any event, I suppose Lyon will continue to provide us with a host of narratives to discuss on the podcast. And for that, yeah, we'll always be grateful. Okay, with that, I will say thank you to Rudy Burrell. I'll say thank you to Michael Jones. Do either of you have anything planned for the rest of the night? Michael, are you going to head out and enjoy the Mancunian evening?
Absolutely not. I'm going to sit in and make myself miserable watching Wolves.
Oh yeah, glutton for punishment, you might say. Glutton for punishment, Michael. Rudy Burrell, what are your plans for this evening? Anything at all, or are you just chilling?
No, I'm watching quite a lot of football, I imagine. There's plenty of La Liga on this evening. And then I have interviews and stuff to write up. I was speaking to Rodrigo De Paul even last week, so that was good fun. And just finding some derivatives off that.
Beautiful stuff, Paul. I'm sure Rodrigo De Paul enjoyed spending time with you. Okay, good stuff. Okay, I am going to log off. I'm going to go and enjoy what is left of a beautifully sunny evening in the south side of Glasgow. I'll say thank you to you, the listener. Hope you're all staying safe. Hope you're all staying well. Until next time, goodbye.